The lecturer is Professor Peter Saccio. Professor Saccio is an award-winning professor and accomplished writer, actor, and theatrical director. He received his Ph.D. from Princeton University and began his teaching career at Dartmouth College in 1966, where he continues today. He has also served as a visiting professor at Wesleyan University and at University College in London. Professor Saccio has published or delivered at conferences more than 20 papers on Shakespeare and other dramatists. He is the author of two books, including Shakespeare's English Kings, which was released in 1977 and has become a classic in its field. He is also the editor of Thomas Middleton's comedy, A Mad World, My Masters, for the Oxford Complete Works of Thomas Middleton. In addition to his writing and public speaking career, Professor Saccio is also an accomplished director and actor. He has directed productions of Twelfth Night, Macbeth, and Cymbeline, and has devised and directed several programs of scenes from Shakespeare and from modern British drama. His acting credits include the Shakespearean roles of Casca, Angelo, Bassanio, and Henry IV, as well as various parts in the ancient and modern plays. His teaching awards include Dartmouth's J. Kenneth Huntington Memorial Award for Outstanding Teaching. Each of Professor Saccio's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. You may find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Photographs of on-stage productions for this series were provided in part by the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C. The lectures on these tapes are titled William Shakespeare, Comedies, Histories, and Tragedies, Part 1.
Hello, my name is Peter Saccio. I teach Shakespeare at Dartmouth, where I have been for more years than I care to count. And this is a course in the plays of William Shakespeare. It will explore some of the most powerful works of art available to us in the Western tradition. They first filled theaters in London 400 years ago, and they continue to please, to move, and to enlighten many people today. Just how they please, move, and enlighten us is our business in this course. 38 plays of Shakespeare survive. They are not all that Shakespeare wrote. There's a sequence of 154 sonnets, some half dozen other poems, long and short. We know he had a hand in several other plays whose texts survive, and several whose texts are lost, apparently forever. Since he was the house playwright for a busy theatrical company, I'm sure that he also did lots of other writing, of which we have no record now, doctoring other playwrights' plays, putting in a scene here, a speech there. Hey, Will, we're doing this terrible old thing of Kids next week. Could you put in some stuff to juice up the betrayal scene? That kind of stuff. That's what a house playwright does. All this work was done in the space of about a quarter of a century. From about 1589, when Shakespeare was in his mid-20s, to about 1612, as he approached the age of 50. If you have trouble remembering dates, perhaps an easy way to remember it is this. This is four centuries ago. Take the year 1600 as the midpoint. It is the midpoint of Shakespeare's career. It's the date of Hamlet. And he was working 12 years before that and about 12 years after that. Hamlet's the great crossing place. He was a productive man, and he was appreciated in his own time. About the year 1601, a Cambridge scholar named Gabriel Harvey scribbled some notes evaluating current English writing. Among his comments was the following on a certain poet and playwright who had been gaining attention. The younger sort takes much delight in Shakespeare's Venus and Adonis, but his Lucrece and his Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, have it in them to please the wiser sort. Now, Gabriel Harvey was a vain and waspish man, the sort of nasty, argumentative shrew that gives academics a bad name. In fact, he was so quarrelsome that he couldn't get promotion even in his own university, let alone a decent job outside when he tried to do that. And you can see his condescension toward the younger sort, who like love poems, amorous poetry like Venus and Adonis. But his remark is also reassuring, the remark about Hamlet. A play that we find great now was appreciated in its own time by a demanding critic. In fact, the remark flatters us. Hamlet pleases the wiser sort. Well, I like Hamlet. I must be one of the wiser sort. Shakespeare in his own time pleased tastes less demanding than that of Gabriel Harvey. Some 10 years before Harvey jotted down his notes, a much more genial man, a hack writer called Thomas Nash, wrote the earliest surviving description of an audience at a Shakespeare play. Nash describes a direct, open-hearted response that audience gave to plays dramatizing English history. He's speaking in particular about the death of Lord Talbot, one of the generals of the Hundred Years' War against France, and the hero of Shakespeare's play, Henry VI, Part I. This is what Nash writes. What if I prove plays to be no extreme vice, but a rare exercise of virtue? First, for the subject of them, it is for the most part borrowed out of our English chronicles, wherein our forefathers' valiant acts that have lain long buried in rusty brass and worm-eaten books are revived, and they themselves raised from the grave of oblivion and brought to plead their ancient honors in open presence. Than which, what could be a sharper reproof to these degenerate, effeminate days of ours? How it would have joyed brave Talbot, the terror of the French, to think that after he had lain 200 years in his tomb, he should triumph again on the stage, and have his bones new embalmed with the tears of 10,000 spectators at least, who in the tragedian that represents his person, imagine they behold him fresh bleeding. Now, as the first sentence indicates, Nash has his own axe to grind. He wants to prove that stage plays are a virtue, not a vice. He is an occasional playwright himself, and he's defending the stage against Puritan attack. The extract I have quoted is part of a debate over the morality of the stage that extends from the 1560s, when Shakespeare was a toddler, to 30 years after his death, when in 1642, the Puritans gained a majority in Parliament and passed an act forbidding all theatrical performance in England. Now, the Puritans are the radical Protestants. They're the left wing of the political religious spectrum. They want to carry the Reformation further, to turn England into the New Jerusalem, make it as much like the primitive church as possible. And they held that the stage was immoral. The stage was immoral in itself because acting is pretense, passing yourself off as something other than what God made you to be. It is also immoral in its effect, since the plots of practically every play involve some sinful behavior, and the audience might be tempted to go home and imitate those sinful acts. Nash is trying to answer both points. He argues that the pretense, in fact, honors the subject, that Talbot would be delighted to know that his heroic deeds of a century and a half earlier are being reenacted on the stage. Moreover, the effect of this impersonation is highly moral, not immoral at all. The audience is inspired by the heroic example and reproved for its modern degeneracy. But at the heart of this polemic, Nash records a fact, and it's that fact that I'm chiefly interested in at the moment. At several performances, large audiences were deeply moved by the valor and heroism of Talbot. They were so drawn into the theatrical illusion that they momentarily believed that they were witnessing the real thing, that they behold in the tragedian that represents his person, they behold him fresh bleeding. They see the death of Talbot himself. And it's an interesting linguistic fact that I just discovered this past fall, that in English, the word personate, meaning take on the identity of another individual, comes into common use in this decade of the 1590s, when Nash is writing about Shakespeare's early performances. By starting with two contemporary quotations in praise of Shakespeare, I do not mean to suggest that while he was still alive, he was held in the extraordinary esteem that he is now. Now, he is a cultural icon, the biggest name there is in Western literature. But I do want to establish that his plays were successful, that they earned him both profit and credit in his own time. He was not a closet genius unknown to his contemporaries. And some of the ways in which the Elizabethan audience appreciated him continue now. The association of his work with English patriotism, which Nash makes clear in talking about Talbot, has continued to this day. The best-known 20th century use of Shakespeare for the building of patriotic morale has been the film of Henry V, made by Laurence Olivier in 1944, to which the British government contributed some funding, and which Olivier dedicated to the British troops. It was a project in which Winston Churchill himself was deeply interested. He was aware of the value of cinema for public morale. I know a woman, in fact I've been directed in the theater by her, who is now in her late 80s. At the end of the war in 1945, when that film opened in London, she was a very young mother living in London. And she told me she went back to see that film every 2 weeks. It gave her the necessary boost to carry on in London when Hitler's V2 bombs were still falling on the city. But Shakespeare has been many other things to his own time and to later generations, many other things than a patriot. He has been the source of livelihood to actors. The theatrical company of which he was part for most of his years in the theater became the most successful of his time. They were called the Lord Chamberlain's Men. When they were founded in the year 1594, their official patron was the Lord Chamberlain of the court of Queen Elizabeth I. When Elizabeth died 9 years later and was succeeded by her cousin, King James I, there was a reshuffling of all the patronage at court, and the new patron of Shakespeare's company was the new King James himself. So they were called the King's Men. And under that name, they lasted for another 39 years until the Puritans closed the theaters in 1642. When the theaters opened 28 years after that, in 1660, after the Puritan interregnum, the old companies had, of course, long since fallen apart. But there were actors here and there who wanted to get back on the stage as soon as they could. Of course, nobody had been writing new plays. Nobody writes plays if there's no chance of getting them produced. So for a while, the actors had to resort to the old repertoire, which meant Ben Jonson and Beaumont and Fletcher and Shakespeare. And this carries on into the 18th century, the next century, when Ben Jonson and Beaumont and Fletcher begin to be less interesting to current audiences, but Shakespeare goes on being revived again and again. Indeed, by the 18th century, English actors have come to be evaluated chiefly on their ability to perform Shakespeare's leading characters. Their portraits come down to us painted in the costumes and the scenes of his plays. We see Garrick as Richard III. We see Mrs. Siddons as Lady Macbeth. And it is still the case. English actors do many things besides Shakespeare, of course. But Shakespeare is where you achieve real distinction and fame. I cut out a clipping of this morning's paper, which quotes Dame Judi Dench, one of the really distinguished senior Shakespearean actresses currently at work. She says, Shakespeare is known in our house as the gentleman who pays the rent. Now, Shakespeare is a source of livelihood to more than Dame Judi. He is a source of livelihood to Britain as a whole. Much of the Royal Shakespeare Company's audience at Stratford-on-Avon consists, of course, of overseas tourists. Europeans, Japanese, North Americans. The plays are a magnet that brings money not only to the theaters, but to the restaurants, the hotel keepers, the airlines, the souvenir shops. He has also become an educational staple. This began to happen in the 19th century, as the British step by step extended the franchise, the ability to vote to more and more classes of people. As they did that, the British government realized they also had to expand the schools. These new voters from the lower middle classes and the working classes had to be educated. What should they learn? Well, working class people really cannot be expected to learn Latin or Greek like their upper class betters. So English literature begins to replace the classics in the curriculum. If they can't read Julius Caesar in his original writing, they can at least read about Julius Caesar in Shakespeare's play. By the end of the century, English had become an acceptable subject of study in the universities as well as the schools, and that meant that research on Shakespeare, editing his plays, commenting on them, an activity which had formerly been in the province of private scholars and societies, moved into the hands of academics. Shakespeare is the gentleman who pays my rent, too. Players, shopkeepers, schoolmasters, college professors, we all have a heavy vested interest in Shakespeare. But beyond the economic argument, Shakespeare has assumed a massive centrality to English-speaking cultures. Indeed, to all the European-based cultures. There are, after all, Italian operas and Russian novels that make heavy use of Shakespeare. West Indian poets who rewrite The Tempest. Shakespeare gets quoted the way the Bible is quoted, to settle some important issue in human affairs. That means, of course, he gets quoted by crackpots as well as by the wiser sort, but I'll mostly ignore the crackpots. This begins late in the 17th century, when Shakespeare is not yet 100 years dead. The poet John Dryden wrote that Shakespeare was the man who, of all modern and perhaps ancient poets, had the largest and most comprehensive soul. Of all modern and perhaps ancient poets. That slight hiccup, that perhaps, comes in because Dryden doesn't quite dare say that Shakespeare is greater than Homer. That's a real step for a 17th century man to take. In the 18th century, Dr. Samuel Johnson echoes that. Shakespeare is, above all writers, the poet of nature, the poet that holds up to his readers the faithful mirror of manners and of life. And that phrase of manners and of life indicates that what he means by nature is not rocks and trees and everything outside. He means human nature, the way people behave. Now, so far, Shakespeare's superlative talents have been said to lie in observation and feeling, a comprehensive soul, a faithful mirror of life. He is the most widely observant and expressive of writers. A jump happens in the 19th century when in England Matthew Arnold, in a famous sonnet, compares Shakespeare to a lofty hill whose top is perceivable only to the stars. It is hid from mortals by clouds. A few years later, in America, Ralph Waldo Emerson, in supposedly sober prose, declares that Shakespeare is inconceivably wise. This I find rather dangerous. The 19th century Shakespeare, the Shakespeare of Arnold and Emerson, is no longer human. A mortal poet, playwright, working with theaters and actors. He has become a god beyond our ken. The attitude that they are expressing is called bardolatry. Now, just what Shakespeare is wise about depends on the reader. In matters of philosophy, he has been enlisted on behalf of idealism. He has also been enlisted on behalf of nihilism. In matters of religion, he has been found to favor Roman Catholicism. He has been found to favor Protestantism. He has been found to favor agnosticism and skepticism. In our own century, readers have found him particularly suggestive in political matters. The most influential scholarship of the mid-century, the 1940s and 50s, argued that Shakespeare reflected what was called the Elizabethan world picture. This is a strongly conservative view of the world. God created all things in a vast vertical order, a great chain of being. Angels in their ranks at the top, then human beings and animals, then plants, and then stones down to the smallest mote of dust. Maintaining that order is essential to virtue. All sin can be defined as trying to get out of your place in that order. Shakespeare's plays, particularly the history plays and the tragedies, show conflict to be the result of individuals breaking out of their places, and resolution to be possible only when they return to the proper order. So at least argued scholars like E.M. W. Tilliard in the middle of the century, who had an enormous influence on subsequent scholarship. On the other hand, some of the most energetic criticism of the past 15 years is liberal and indeed radical in its direction, greatly concerned with the injustices perpetrated upon people through distinctions of race, gender, class. Readers influenced by ideas of Marxism and cultural materialism point to passages that appear to sympathize with unprivileged classes rather than with kings and lords. Readers influenced by feminism stress the strength of some of his female characters, or stress the ways in which most women are marginalized or even silenced by a social system that gives power to husbands and fathers. Now, I'm trying to wrap up in a few sentences the painstaking work of scores of scholars, and therefore doing them an injustice. This course is accompanied by a bibliography that can guide you into the libraries of Shakespearean scholarship. My point now is a simple but big one. For many generations, Western culture, particularly English-speaking culture, has found Shakespeare important, found it necessary to relate to Shakespeare on those issues that seem to us to matter most. What we believe, what we find good or evil, how we should organize our relations with each other. Shakespeare is what the anthropologists call a culture hero, a mythical figure who may or may not be based on a real person, a founder of the society, a lawgiver, a prophet. Such a figure, each age must reinterpret according to its own needs. And this applies not only to what is written by scholars to be read in libraries, and what is said by teachers in classrooms, but also to productions of the plays in theaters and in films. When patriotism is needed in World War II, Laurence Olivier films a highly patriotic Henry V. When warfare becomes deeply suspect because of Vietnam and the Falklands, Kenneth Branagh films a skeptical and gritty Henry V. The most extreme form of reinterpreting Shakespeare is to say that he was someone else, to deny that he wrote the plays at all. This is a famous topic. People who know nothing else about Shakespeare know there's been a dispute over this. If I fall into conversation with a stranger at a cocktail party, and let it be known that I teach Shakespeare for a living, I'm almost certain to be asked, well, tell me, did he really write those plays? I shouldn't complain. People with any kind of job have to get used to some idiot question or other. And it's better to be a Shakespearean than a proctologist. No one doubts that there was a William Shakespeare who was born in Stratford-on-Avon and who went on to act in the London theaters and eventually died back in Stratford. What is contested is whether that man wrote the plays that have come down under his name. And the people who contest it propose various different alternatives. Francis Bacon, the Earl of Oxford, Christopher Marlowe, there's a long list. So instead of calling them Baconians or Oxfordians and blah, 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 I refer to them under the blanket title of anti-Stratfordians. The one thing they agree with was that the one thing they agree on is it wasn't the guy from Stratford. Now, anti-Stratfordianism is fascinating because it tells us a great deal about what people look for in a superlative writer. They see a wonderful poet, or a remarkable psychologist, or a great philosopher, or a man capable of expressing the views of an aristocratic class, or a man deeply concerned about the status of women and the oppressed, or any number of things for which there is some basis in the text of Shakespeare's plays. Then they note that the image they've constructed of the writer doesn't seem to cohere with a guy who was born the son of a country glover. The glover himself was probably illiterate, and the son never got beyond grammar school in Stratford. So it must have been somebody else. I must therefore assert at the start of a course of lectures on Shakespeare that there is no mystery here. There is no subject for debate. The facts of Shakespeare's life are as well recorded as anyone could expect, of his domestic life in Stratford, of his professional life in London. We'd like to know more, of course, but we don't know a great deal about the life of any person in his time, except for a few great figures of state and church, like the Queen and the Archbishops and the Lords and Generals, whose activities were naturally given a great deal of attention. We know as much about Shakespeare's life as we know about any other commoner of the time. The Elizabethans did not live filling out the records, keeping the forms the way we do. We do have documents that say, or that make sense only if you assume, that the actor from Stratford and the playwright in London were the same man. If they were not, if those documents are forgeries or lies, then quite a number of people would have to have been engaged in a great conspiracy, for which there is no positive evidence and no attested reason. Anti-Stratfordianism is in fact just crazy if you know anything about how the theater works as a profession at all. Theater is a collaborative art, and people in the theater always know what other people in the theater are doing. Even now, in the much larger world of the New York theater, everybody in it knows everybody else. Everybody knows if someone is ghostwriting someone else. Everybody knows if a new director has been brought in to fix a play. Everybody knows who's understudying such and such a play. Everybody knows who's sleeping together. In the much smaller world of Shakespeare's theater, in London of 1600, when probably no more than 200 people were trying to get a living out of putting on plays at any given time, it is unimaginable that 36 successful plays could be written by someone other than the man to whom they were publicly attributed without someone leaving some statement about the hoax. Anti-Stratfordianism, it's a horrible word, stems from false expectations. People expect that a great playwright would attract curiosity, that we would inherit diaries and personal reminiscences and the like, which we don't have for Shakespeare. But we expect that because successful playwrights today are celebrities. They are interviewed. They are invited to speak on college campuses. Elizabethan playwrights did not attract that kind of attention. They merely provided stage entertainment. If they were very good, they might have aroused the interest of what Gabriel Harvey calls the wiser sort for one scribbled note in his study. But it would be the plays that would provoke interest, not the personality. We expect, or at least some people expect, plays to reflect the personal experience of the writer. Specifically, it is assumed that plays about kings and queens and lords must have been written by an aristocrat. How else would he know how they behaved at court? Hence the suggestion that it was really Bacon who grew up at court and became Chancellor of the Realm. Or Oxford, an aristocrat whose lineage goes back to the Norman Conquest. But that is to mistake the nature of Shakespeare's art, which does not pretend to present a realistic transcription of behavior in high places. No real king or duke ever spoke in spontaneous blank verse. And to suppose that a middle-class boy could not grow up to write tragedies about princes is sheer social snobbery. Most Elizabethan plays are about princes. Yet none of the anti-Stratfordians have ever suggested that the plays of Shakespeare's contemporaries, the plays of Webster or Kidd or Beaumont and Fletcher, were really written by lords. We expect, or at least some of us do, that plays rich in literary allusions and classical references and historical knowledge must have been written by a man with a university education. After all, we need a college education to understand them, or parts of them. Shakespeare did not attend a university. Christopher Marlowe did, so he must have written the plays. But education was different then. Grammar school provided a rich literary training. Grammar, composition, rhetoric, poetry, figurative language, the classics. The universities then were like graduate schools. They were meant for specialized training in theology or medicine or law. From a good grammar school education, and the Stratford Grammar School was good, a smart boy could have developed his verbal skills and also learned how to look things up, how to acquire specialized knowledge that he might want to need to use. Marlowe went to university, true. So did other playwrights like Robert Greene. But Ben Jonson did not. He taught himself, and he was the most learned playwright of the time. And Thomas Kidd did not go to university. And Thomas Middleton went to Oxford but dropped out. Anti-Stratfordianism is the extreme case of reconceptualizing Shakespeare to meet the interests or needs or expectations or fancies of the present. And some of it is really crazy in its methods. But however mad it may be, its fundamental impulse is one common to all readers of Shakespeare. Confronted with enormously stimulating artistic achievement that encompasses a wide variety of human experience, those of us who are stimulated are bound to find something that speaks to our needs, our preoccupations. Those who fear a breakdown of social order find in his works a celebration of hierarchy and harmony as it supposedly existed at some time in the past, because his kings do desire peace. Those who desire to shake up the current establishment enlist him as a social critic on behalf of marginalized people. He writes with equal eloquence for the rulers and the oppressed, for women and for men, for young and for old. He can speak for each character with such authenticity that when it strikes a particular chord in us, we think we hear Shakespeare himself speaking. Of course, it is all Shakespeare, and we all find in his riches something we need to stay in contact with him. Hello. I ended the last lecture by stressing Shakespeare's extraordinary eloquence in speaking for all sorts and conditions of people. That, indeed, is the theme that will link all these lectures together, the variety and richness of his work, and the variety and richness of the ways in which it affects us. Each play is abundant in its contents. There are 5 acts. Usually they're somewhere between 15 and 25 individual scenes, although Antony and Cleopatra has over 40. The total length of the play is always more than 2,000 lines, and with Hamlet gets close to 4,000. The total length is indeed more than our modern customs of theater going normally tolerate, which is why in modern productions the texts are almost always cut. The cast list is long. Greek tragedy permits only 3 speaking actors on stage at any given time, plus, of course, the chorus. Many modern plays are similarly small in focus. For example, the family dramas of Ibsen, of O'Neill, the isolated figures in Beckett. But Shakespeare has never less than 15 characters, and sometimes nearly 50. And there's a lot happening in the plot. Aristotle observed that it was a principle of Greek drama to have a single unified action, but Shakespeare regularly has multiple plots. 3 or 4 couples court one another in a comedy. Their paths sometimes cross, but also sometimes diverge. 3 or 4 parties are scheming against each other in a history or a tragedy. And the number of dead bodies at the end of a tragedy is ultimately controlled only by the absence of a front curtain. You have to have enough living people standing up to carry off the corpses. A similar multiplicity appears in the storylines themselves, the kinds of stories that get told. Greek tragedy stuck almost exclusively to Greek mythology. Medieval drama stuck to biblical stories, to saints' lives, and to moral struggles in allegorical form. The Elizabethans, however, Shakespeare among them, pillaged any narrative source they could find. Classical stories, medieval collections like Chaucer, Italian Renaissance stories like those of Boccaccio, history, whether it be English or European or classical, romances, folk tales, you name it, they lifted it. Shakespeare did not invent his stories. That sort of originality was not especially valued in his time. What mattered was the originality in handling the story, in restructuring them, in finding new significances in them, in combining stories from different sources, developing new characters and incidents. That is why it can be useful to the serious student of Shakespeare to read Shakespeare's sources, all of which have been collected in a magnificent set of 8 volumes by a British scholar named Geoffrey Bullock under the title of The Narrative and Dramatic Sources of Shakespeare. You can learn, by learning the sources, you can make good guesses, you can even deduce what was important to Shakespeare about those stories by looking at what he stresses, keeps, omits, where he brings in something else. For example, the main plot of Measure for Measure is a story that had been many times retold before Shakespeare got a hold of it. A man is condemned to death. A woman who is devoted to him, his wife, his daughter, his sister, what have you, goes to the judge and begs for a pardon. The judge looks at her and says to himself, I want that woman, and makes a bargain with her. If you sleep with me, I'll issue the pardon. The woman agrees to the bargain, but after the judge has had his pleasure, he double-crosses her and executes the convict anyway. And the interest of the story lies in what the woman does next. Now, when the story reached Shakespeare, he made a drastic change. His is the first version of the story in which the woman rejects the bargain, refuses to sleep with the judge. And her convict brother, who values his sister's honor, at first applauds her decision, and then, in terror of death, begs her to change her mind. Please, sister, let me live. But the woman is a young nun, a novice in a nunnery, and her chastity is of great significance to her. So the whole focus of the story has been changed so that the struggle between two rival values is pursued. Which is more important, chastity or charity? Also contributing to the abundance of Shakespeare is the theater itself. The typical Elizabethan theater was an amphitheater, a polygonal building with 16 or 20 sides, designed rather like a tall donut. The stage projected from the inner wall of one side out into the central space. The cheapest audience accommodation was to stand around that space. Around the stage. If you could afford more, then you sat in one of the galleries that went up on the sides. The stage was both wide and deep, with two doors in the rear for entrances, and between the doors, a booth or discovery space that could be used for special effects. This large stage is about 40 feet wide. Could accommodate many actors. You can do crowd scenes, court scenes, battle scenes, fencing displays. The duel at the end of Hamlet is a real duel between people who know how to use those weapons. That is, the stage could be epic in its scale. Yet because the audience stood or sat about three quarters of the way around, they could, and because those galleries go straight up instead of being recessed like in a modern Broadway theater, all the audience is really quite close to the stage. Nobody is more than 40 feet away from an actor standing downstage center. Therefore, it is possible to do very intimate scenes, to have scenes between two people, or to have a quiet soliloquy, one character, like Hamlet, meditating on the meaning of his experience. You get quite closely inside his mind. This is an extraordinarily flexible stage. Nothing more flexible in entertainment was invented, in the West at least, until the movies came along. The movies, of course, can give us the epic scale and the intimacy even better than this stage. But they do so at the price of putting it all on film. The action and the actors are no longer live. The stage also had trap doors. Characters could descend beneath the stage floor into what was called the hell. It was also partly roofed over, the front part of the roof being supported by columns or pillars. And those pillars go all the way up to the top level, so that most of the audience, standing in the pit or seated in the galleries, can see the underside of that canopy roof. And that was painted with stars and constellations, and was sometimes called the heavens. They have built, a couple of years ago, in London, a replica, a full-size replica of Shakespeare's Globe. It is called Shakespeare's Globe, and they are putting on a full summer season of plays there now. I strongly recommend that you go there if you can. Those two terms, the heaven above, the hell below the stage, remind us of the Christian heritage of this Elizabethan theater. Men and women work out their destiny on earth between the alternatives of heaven and hell. The world of the Elizabethan stage was not only vertical, it was also horizontal. Let me go back for a moment to the size of the stage, to those crowd and court and battle scenes. This is a stage big enough to accommodate what Rosalind, in As You Like It, calls the full stream of the world. What Macduff calls pleasures in a spacious plenty. Unlike Greek plays, unlike most modern drama, where one family may stand for society only by metaphor, this stage really can present a large population. The big stage goes along with the multiple plots of the play. People dwell in a broad society, different kinds, different social levels of men and women. We focus not just on their personal lives, we are also made to focus on them in a large social context. And the big stage goes along with kinds of scenes that Shakespeare writes. The throne rooms and battlefields that I mentioned, but also, to take an odd example, eavesdropping scenes. Eavesdropping is frequent in Shakespeare. It's hard to stage when Shakespeare is put on television because the television screen is small. But on the Elizabethan stage, eavesdropping is a natural activity. You can have one pair of characters doing something stage left and other characters watching them, sufficient distance apart for it to be credible, but both groups are within our view so that we have the event and the commentary simultaneously. There's even a case in Troilus and Cressida of multiple eavesdropping. In the Greek camp, Cressida is reluctantly yielding to the seduction of Diomed. Watching them is Cressida's lover, Troilus, to whom she has sworn fidelity, who is horror-struck by this event and thinks the whole world is falling to pieces because his girl is unfaithful. He is accompanied by an older, wiser, worldly Greek, Ulysses, who keeps telling Troilus, "Don't make so much fuss about it. This is the sort of thing that happens. It's the way of the world." And there's a fifth character watching also, Thersites, the complete cynic, who tells us in the audience, "This just proves what I always said, all people are whores and knaves." In other words, we have an event that means five different things simultaneously. To Cressida, who is being seduced, she is alone and scared and needs male protection and is finally reluctantly willing to pay a price for it. Diomed just wants the girl for the night. And it means three different things to each of the three male observers. The event no sooner happens, but it's got five interpretations. That's an example of the abundance of Shakespeare. Let me expand on this. A Shakespearean play gives us a sense of panorama, a view of life in breadth and in depth. We are concerned with the private lives of people, their inner natures, there's the depth. We are also concerned with the worlds, the nature and fate of the societies in which they live. At the end of the most famous speech Shakespeare gives to King Richard II, Richard insists that he is not a king at all. He is a man as other men are, a man quite like those he is talking to. "I live with bread like you, feel want, taste grief, need friends. Subjected thus, how can you say to me, I am a king?" It is a characteristic Shakespearean moment when we look through the king to see the Richard. Look through the political position and see the human being who occupies that position, and in this case does not fit it very well. Shakespeare's plays provide us with some of the most intense personal experience available in drama or any other form of literature. The anguished soliloquies of Macbeth, the angry confrontation of Hamlet with his mother, the balcony scene between Romeo and Juliet, or the teasing affection between pairs of lovers in the comedies. These scenes make us acquainted with characters of remarkable fullness, with emotions of power, and subtlety, and depth. Playgoers and readers find him intimately acquainted with the human condition, with the human heart. Indeed, it has been said by several modern critics, of whom Harold Bloom is the best known, that Shakespeare invented that thing that we call the self, the complex psyche, the private identity that is partly but not wholly self-aware, tremulous and changing. I'm going to shy away from a bold statement like that, that Shakespeare invented the self. There are other writers before Shakespeare who had some awareness of the self and its instabilities. But Shakespeare certainly found brilliant ways of making that self speak. He gave artistic form to the notion that people are complex selves, that they have private lives that stand in opposition to their public appearance and to the social circumstances and forces that surround them. He found means in dialogue, monologue, and subtext for the complications of private life to be revealed. Later in this course, when we get to Macbeth, I will try to demonstrate that he invented the modern soliloquy, a form of speech in which the complexities of the self are revealed to an eavesdropping audience, even more fully than, the speaker himself realizes. And because Shakespeare has become a kind of culture hero, because he is one of the founders of modern Western culture, and his plays have remained central to our artistic and educational practices, we derive from him important notions about our private selves. Opposed to Richard II, moving from divine right king to privately suffering man, let me pose Romeo. Early in the third act, Romeo would like to be altogether private, to deal with the world solely on the basis of his love for Juliet. Romeo and Juliet have declared their love for each other, have been secretly married, and are only waiting for nighttime fully to consummate their union. In the hot midday sun, Romeo encounters Tybalt and wants to treat him with the love that he feels for the whole world in his happy, newly married state. But Tybalt is a Capulet and sees Romeo not as a loving man, but simply as a Montague, a member of the rival family, an opponent in the feud that divides Verona. And Tybalt's antagonism leads quickly to the death of Mercutio and of Tybalt himself and Romeo's own banishment from Verona. The personal feelings of the hero of the play are erased. What happens to him thereafter is determined by his public position as the son of one of the two feuding families who dominate the city. The personal feelings of one man cannot deflect a city full of history, social history. Young lovers are part of a multi-generational social order. Likewise, Hamlet, the most famous soliloquizer in Shakespeare, whom we usually think of as standing alone or talking to the skull of Yorick, also has a position as crown prince.